those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. This is the word of the Lord, and we believe it. Good to see all of you. I am glad that you are here. In my hometown in Michigan, there was a local high school that had an annual Christmas concert, and it was called the Singing Christmas Tree. Now, I'm not sure exactly how they did it, but they had a special kind of scaffolding where the choir would come, and it would look like a Christmas tree, because kind of a pyramid shape, where you've got the choir members who are kind of going up this scaffolding, and looked like a Christmas tree. I don't know what they dressed as. Maybe they were all in green or something. I don't know. Beats me. And the big deal was, I think if I remember right, there was a tradition around it, but the choir would actually elect one of its members to be the top of the Christmas tree. And maybe that person wore gold or something, like a star or an angel. I don't remember. And I don't remember, actually, I don't remember if I've been to the concert or not, but it was this big deal every year. And there was only one place that could really hold this scaffolding, and it was at a local Catholic church called Prince of Peace Catholic Church. First time when I heard Prince of Peace, singing in our Lutheran church, I could only think of the Catholic church, because they're the ones named Prince of Peace. So anyway, why do I tell you this silly little story? Well, this is the throne name of God we're talking about today, the Prince of Peace. And this is one of those prophetic names given to the Messiah before he actually showed up on the scene. And of course, we originally started talking about the not just a wonderful counselor, but a wonder-working counselor. And then when we talk about mighty God, your mind might go to different things, but really, the word that's used here means that this is a God who fights and fights on your behalf. And then last week we talked about the everlasting Father, and maybe it's a better way of translating it as eternal Father, the one who exists outside of time and is the beginning of all things, and just this mystery and wonder that surrounds that. And today, Prince of Peace seems to be the one that we remember the most about the throne names. Whether it's a local Catholic church, which, by the way, Catholics always have the best names for churches, don't they? I mean, really, Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility and, all those kinds of names. But Prince of Peace is that throne name that's actually applied to Jesus and to the Messiah, and it is the one we remember. And it's probably because every person I know is looking for some calm in the midst of the turmoil. I think we resonate with this idea of Prince of Peace readily, just because of circumstance. And let's be honest, right now, there's a lot of turmoil in this world. And we all know it. And it's one of those things that's always kind of playing in the background. And so when we talk about wars and rumors of war, and Jesus made it clear that that's the way it was going to be. I really think when Jesus was talking about there will be wars and rumors of wars, it's less prophetic and more just a statement of reality of the way the human beings are. And so we're looking for something that's peaceful amidst all that turmoil, and it doesn't have to be on an international level. It can be just within your own heart too, right? And everyone, we know. And why is it that it seems like this time of year tends to stir all that stuff up? Have you noticed that? kind of does that. I don't know if it's just the stress of the season or what it is, but it seems like all of those things begin bubbling up to the the surface. Now, like all of the other throne names of the Messiah, this one has two parts to it in Hebrew, and the first one is Ser. It's really simple. It typically is applied to nobility, aristocracy. And so prince is certainly appropriate because that would be almost the pinnacle, some type of noble other than a king, right? So prince in this particular case, noble. But the other thing to kind of throw into the mix is that it can also be applied to a ruler or to a chief. And so if we're going to use modern language, instead of using the word prince, I think it'd be very appropriate to say leader. You know, someone who leads, someone who has a certain amount of authority, at least, you know, positionally, you know, authority to affect, you know, certain types of change. And so there's this notion of prince, and we all have this idea, kind of our own mental definition of that. But the word is a little more utilitarian than just simply prince. It can be applied to a chief or to a ruler. And so I think leader is appropriate. And of course, the second term here is shalom, peace, typically is how it's translated. But shalom is one of those words in Hebrew that, boy, it deserves some attention because we get this idea of what peace means. And a lot of you have heard me talk about this in the past, but we have this idea of what peace really means. And yet the Hebrew understanding of peace is a lot more robust. I'm going to use that word because it's something beyond like inner tranquility. There's a lot more to it than that. And I want to talk about this. And so the general idea in English when we talk about peace is kind of this idea of lack of conflict, right? And, you know, somebody's at peace. They know they don't, you know, have conflict or there's a certain amount of calm to it. But shalom carries more than that idea of either inner tranquility or just a ceasefire, right? And it's a little more than that. There's more to it. And so if we went to Israel today and you would be greeted by a modern Jew, they would say shalom to you. Peace be with you. And all the Methodists would say, and also with you. You know, kind of a thing, right? Interestingly enough, that in Arabic, the greeting is salam, which also means peace. And it's kind of an interesting parallel between the two languages. And this is kind of my own working theory, because I find this just fascinating, because the ancient Middle East, as we understand it today, was rooted in what I would call Bedouin culture, desert nomads, moving from place to place, either on trade routes or looking for forage for flocks and herds and that sort of thing. And what we know from anthropology is that there were certain rules that everybody followed. In fact, they call it, for lack of a better term, desert law. It wasn't necessarily codified within a book or anything, but there were certain customs that everyone sort of followed, and there were reasons for it, typically for survival. Because if you're in a harsh environment like a desert wilderness, guess what? You're going to need some help from time to time. And if you're going to need some help, then other people need help. And if you wanted help, you probably ought to give it. And it's a very simple concept, but it's very, very true. And at the core of all of the desert law is this notion of hospitality. Hospitality is an important feature in that environment because it promotes survival of everybody. You need cooperation. Maybe that's the better word for it. Hospitality is kind of born out of this idea of cooperation. Survival will make you do stuff, I think. And so when we talk about hospitality, at least in the sense of desert law, is that it's tied to reputation. You have a reputation for offering, you know, hospitality to people in need. And of course, there's a spiritual dimension to all of this that I think is kind of unspoken, in the sense that if you didn't provide hospitality, no one may know or not know, but the divine did. And so you were doing hospitality in light of the divine, of what was going on in your spiritual life. And so there's this spiritual component to hospitality. It wasn't something nice that you did for someone. It wasn't necessarily transactional, but it was definitely something that you did out of obligation to the divine. And the divine knew your reputation. Hospitality was given often lavishly, and hospitality was received with grace. So it wasn't just on one part, but it was on both parts. And I want to give you a picture of hospitality. The best person to kind of access this idea is an Old Testament character named Abraham. You might have heard of him because he had many sons, and many sons had Father Abraham. Anyway, we're in Genesis chapter 18. If you want to turn there, that would be great. But I'm going to read a few verses. I want you to hear this. there's something that happens in here that's a little confusing, and so I want to explain this a little bit. So Genesis chapter 18, beginning with verse 1, a picture of hospitality, okay? The Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent. In the heat of the day, Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. Now, first of all, it says the Lord appeared to Abraham, but the indication here is that three men appeared, and there's no indication that Abraham knew it was the Lord, at least at the beginning, okay? So it's a little confusing when you read this. The Lord appeared. That's the author telling us what was going on, but it's not clear that Abraham knew that right away, okay? So keep that in mind. Three men appeared, and what does he do? He runs from the entrance of his tent and bows low to the ground. This is hospitality. Notice what happens next. He said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under this tree. Let me get you something to eat so you can be refreshed and then go on your way now that you have come to your servant." "Very well," they answered, "do as you say." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah, that's his wife. "Quick," he said, "get three seahs of fine flour and knead it and bake some bread." Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice tender calf and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. He then brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While they ate, he stood near them under a tree. So you have Abraham in his tent. He is Bedouin. He is a desert nomad. He moves where the forage is, and he moves his flocks, and he's very wealthy, and he has a great reputation. And so when travelers come by, the first thing he does is offers them hospitality. Now, it's one thing to say, "Here, wash your feet." It's something else to prepare a pretty big feast, because he not only went to get just something to eat, he actually had a choice tender calf prepared for them. I don't know about you, but barbecue takes a long time, right? I mean, we're not, you know, we're talking about cooking this thing up and preparing it. This isn't a 5-minute, "Well, let me see what's in the refrigerator and throw it together for you," right? I mean, this is kind of a big deal. But that's hospitality. The point is I want to bless you because you have come to me. And there's almost this divine sense that there's a reason why God brought you to me, not realizing it was God himself who is showing up. Now, interestingly enough, after this, this is where God talks about Sarah having a baby. And so it's interesting to me that in this idea of hospitality, not only has Abraham attempted to bless the travelers, but the travelers in gratitude bless Abraham. Do you see that? That's the desert law playing itself out. It is given lavishly, and it is received with grace and often with a great deal of gratitude. So God prophesies over Sarah, blesses them with a child. Hosts offered his family's best freely, and the guests receive with gratitude. It is polite. It is born out of necessity of a harsh climate because you might need someone else to help you out. And notice that each part to this had a responsibility. Both the one offering and the one receiving have a responsibility. One does so freely, lavishly, best as they possibly can. The other receives with grace and with gratitude and attempts to bless on the way back. And when we think about this word shalom, this idea of peace, it's against the backdrop of desert law. It's this notion that there are responsibilities here. It is not your inner tranquility, but it is a relational peace that's going on. And everyone is living up to their responsibilities within that relationship. And what's so interesting is that later on, when we read about the law of Moses, we see the same idea carried out into the Torah, the law of the Jews. Because if you had a family member who could not live up to their responsibility into a relationship, it was the job of the family to step in and deal with that obligation. Because reputation and hospitality and shalom was at stake for everyone. So it wasn't just about you, but about the relationship that you had within a larger community. And it was a big deal. That's why we have things like kinsmen redeemers and blood avengers, and we find all of those things within the Old Testament, but it's against the backdrop of hospitality and shalom that is a relational thing, so that everybody could be in balance and there could be equilibrium and everyone would be able to enjoy their lives as best as they possibly could. So let's be clear about this, because I think this is something that may get overlooked. God is holy, and he desires us to be holy like him. But here's the problem. We can't live up to that responsibility, can we? And so what does he do? He sends his son to take up the part of the obligation that we can't fulfill. It's hospitality. It's shalom. So as the Father, the everlasting Father, he steps in and gives us the ability to be in balance, to be in equilibrium, to be in shalom. Do you see that? That is a profound thing, I think. And we have to be careful that we don't overlook it. And so when we see Sarah Shalom, we see Prince of Peace. It's not simply the prince who rules over a peaceful situation, but rather it's one who brings peace to the situation. Do you see that? Instead of saying Prince of Peace, I like the idea the prince who brings peace. I think that's a better understanding of this, because he's making up for all of the stuff that we can't do. And there's a lot of it. He is operating as the everlasting, the eternal Father. He's doing the family obligation. He's the one who is bringing peace to the circumstances. And the Old Testament is filled with pictures of shalom, of this idea of balance and peace. Probably the best known one is the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1 and 2. That was an idea of what shalom ought to look like, what peace ought to be like. You can find it again in Ezekiel chapter 47 when you see this river flowing from the temple, from the throne of God, and it's spreading throughout the land, and it's getting bigger and deeper, and there's trees of life growing on either side of it, and again, that's a picture of peace, at least metaphorically. And of course, the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21 and 22, again, is a picture of peace where everybody is living harmoniously with one another in the light of God himself. That's the peace. Or how about the lion laying down with the lamb in Isaiah chapter 11? I mean, there's all kinds of pictures where God is just kind of giving us these little glimpses. Yeah, this is what it looks like. Here's what it looks like. Metaphorically, you ought to think about it this way, but this is what peace is. And there's one that I like an awful lot, and I want to read this to you. This is in Micah chapter 4. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Oh, good, I did mark it. Micah chapter 4. You don't have to turn there, but let me read this to you. Micah 4, verse 1. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. And here's the picture. Every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. That sounds pretty good right now, doesn't it? I like this verse because my dad used to talk about wanting to grow a grapevine so he could just sit under it in the summertime, pick the grapes off and eat them. I don't know if he ever did that, but I know that he talked about it an awful lot. And every time I read this passage, I can see the look on my dad's face. It was a little wistful. And I was like, oh, it'd be great to just reach up and eat my own grapes. Okay. But shalom means balance and peace. And the other thing that it means is that there's enough for everybody. Notice how every person here mentioned, every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree. And these are kind of luxury items. We're not talking just about basics. We're talking about really good food. There's enough for each person. However, there's a little caution, too, that I want to throw in here, because I think this is interesting. In the course of kings over Israel, there's basically four that are considered good, and everybody else not so good. You've got David, you've got Solomon, you have Hezekiah and Josiah. And you go through the text, and it will say very clearly that the ones that walked before the Lord and the ones who did not. And those are the four who did. However, none of them lived without problems, and Hezekiah in particular. So if you get a chance to read, it's in 2 Kings, but kind of the political environment was that Hezekiah ruled over Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel. And it was what we would call a vassal state to Assyria. So Assyria would be kind of modern day Iraq. And the Assyrians were brutal. That would be putting it mildly. But they were the superpower. And if you wanted the Assyrians to leave you alone, you paid them tribute. So you became a vassal state. So basically, it's like running an extortion racket, okay? Just not in a neighborhood on a like kind of international scale. And so this is what the Assyrians did. And in Judah, this southern kingdom ruled by Hezekiah was a vassal state. And at some point, for whatever reason, Hezekiah rebelled and it decided that he wasn't going to do that anymore. Here it is in 2 Kings chapter 18. Let me just read this briefly. Where is it here? 2 Kings 18, verse 7. And the Lord was with Hezekiah. He was successful in whatever he undertook. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. Okay. Now, do you think that the racketeer here, Assyria, is going to let a source of income just decide not to pay? Guido wouldn't let somebody not pay, so neither is Assyria, all right? I mean, this is just kind of the way bad guys work. We all know this. We've watched movies. Come on. We know how this is. And so they show up to Jerusalem in force, and that would have been a terrifying thing. You need to understand, I mean, I cannot possibly overstate how brutal this particular people group and army actually was to its neighbors. I cannot overstate that. But look what Assyria says to Jerusalem. This is verse 28. Then the commander, the Assyrian commander, stood and called out in Hebrew. It's interesting. Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. This is what the king says. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you. He cannot deliver you from my hand. Do not let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord when he says, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah. This is what the king of Assyria says. Make peace with me, Shalom, and come out to me. Then every one of you will eat from his own vine and fig tree and drink water from his own cistern. Sound familiar? It's a picture of peace, even among other ancient Near Eastern peoples. I think there's an idiom here. I think there's a way of understanding it that when we talk about your own vine and your own fig tree and your own cistern, that really is kind of an idiomatic way of describing peace, okay? Eating grapes and figs, yeah, that's a picture of peace. Now, here's the point that I want to make, and you need to pay attention to this because I think this is really important, and I don't want you to miss it. Look what he says next in verse 32. He says, come out to me, and then all of you will eat and drink. Verse 32, you will do that until I come and take you to a land like your own, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey. Choose life, not death. So you're going to be fine. You're going to be able to do all those things until I come and move you somewhere else. And see, that was the way Assyria worked. It does a great job of quelling insurrection when you take large populations from their home country and move them to another part of the empire. They're not familiar with the terrain. They're not tied to the land anymore. It's not theirs. They're moved. And so consequently, you end up with a lot less rebellion. Okay, Hezekiah, you want to play this game? Fine, we're going to pick you up and we're going to move you somewhere else and you're not going to have that stability anymore. Pretty effective. Worked for the Assyrians, also worked for the Babylonians, by the way. This is an important thing. But he says, come, make peace with me and you'll be able to do all that stuff until I take you somewhere else. Now, it'll be just as good, but it won't be in your land. It won't be in the land that God gave you. It'll be the land that the Assyrian king gave you. So ultimately what he's saying is, yeah, your God is not as good as me. And so I think there's a lesson all of us need to be aware of. Beware of peace from any other source than God. I really believe that, is that one of the things when you're evaluating your set of circumstances or a decision you have to make, and you're looking to find some peace within your heart, and okay, let me say it this way. Sometimes when we're faced with something difficult, I hear people say things like, I'm not at peace with it. I understand that. But sometimes that's just an excuse to not face something difficult. If it's difficult, you're not going to feel at peace with it until the other side. Does this make sense? And so you have to be really careful of what's the source of peace. If the source of peace is just not dealing with something, I'm not sure you're on solid ground there. But rather, you want to beware the source of peace. Don't settle for anything less than the peace that the Prince brings you. Are you tracking with me? And that requires a little bit of work. That requires spending some time in his presence. Now, back in October, when we talked about spiritual warfare, we talked about how decisions will ultimately tilt us toward either heaven or hell, good or evil, life or death, order versus chaos. And I think when we're talking about shalom, thinking about this idea of order is a really good way of thinking about it. The Messiah brings order. He's the Prince of Peace, and peace comes from and with a certain amount of order to it. But here's the rub, and this is where I think we all miss it, myself included. So I'm preaching to me here. I'm not preaching to anyone else. The Messiah is committed to order, always. And he's committed to peace. But you must understand he is willing to go through chaos to get it. That's a much better point than your reaction to it. He's committed to peace. He's the bringer of peace, but he will go through chaos in order to get it. The promise of the kingdom of God was gained through the chaos of the cross. Do you see it? He went through that chaos in order to bring you the kingdom, which is order and peace, the way God intended it. And so it is with each one of us. Every single one of us has a certain amount of growth and development that we need. And God wants each of us to go through those things. And those things are only obtained through the struggle. Going through it, not avoiding it. Now, don't get me wrong. It is perfectly acceptable to say things like, oh, Lord, I would really like to not go through this trial, right? In fact, we see this even in the Lord's Prayer. And lead us not into temptation. The better understanding of that is, oh, don't let us go through the hard stuff, right? There's nothing wrong with asking God, like, yeah, it'd be great if there was some way else we could achieve this. But please understand, his commitment is to order and to your peace, but he's willing to go through the chaos to get you there. Facing your problems seems chaotic. Dealing with difficult relationships seems chaotic. Confronting evil seems very chaotic. And this is why faith is so crucial to all of it. Remember, my definition of faith is this growing trust in God with more and more of my life, including the chaotic stuff. The shalom that you seek is on the other side of the challenge. It's on the other side of the chaos. But you're not going through it alone. You're going through it with the Prince who brings peace. Do you see that? That's what he's calling you to. He's calling you forward. He's calling you out of these. And it's scary, and it's uncomfortable, and it's painful. But what you're saying is, Jesus, I'm going to trust you through it. That's not easy. But that's what we're called to. Because if we avoid the chaos, if we ignore the chaos, if we ignore confronting those things, we run a horrible risk of not actually achieving the peace that we could. You might get it for a time, but how many of you know it comes back to bite you later on? Yeah, most of us know that. Or the other thing that seems to occur, it comes up like a bad penny over and over again. And you think, I thought I learned this lesson. Did you, or did you just ignore it? And that's the question you ask yourself. God, this is coming up again? What am I missing here? How do I trust you through this? Trust, in my mind, comes from being in the presence of the Messiah, of like deliberately saying, Lord, I need to experience your presence because I know that the peace that I'm searching for only comes when you bring it. And that may not be easy. Now, I don't know where you are today. I don't know what the holidays does to you internally. Most of us have great traditions that we're excited about, and it's a lot of fun, but sometimes there are other parts that we would just really like to not deal with. You may have a crazy uncle or cousin or something. You may have uncomfortable conversations whenever your family gets together. It may be the stress of completing some things before year end. And a whole host of your own issues. You know what they are. And so my invitation to you today is to pause and consider what it means to serve the one who has the name, the Prince who brings peace. But I'm not feeling peace right now. Right. Because you're in the chaos. Are you going to trust him through that? Are you going to trust the one who has the name, Prince of Peace, Mighty God, Everlasting Father? That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where this gets real. Because it's one thing to say it, it's one thing to sing it, something else entirely to trust him through it. God, I'm grateful that we have an insight not only into these names, but your character. You really do have our best interest at heart. We say that we want peace, the peace that you bring. And so I would just encourage everyone here who is looking for that peace to reach out, grab you by the hand, and say, Lord, I trust you. And I know, sure as I'm standing here, there are people who are having a conversation in their head. Yeah, but that preacher, he doesn't know anything about my circumstances. You're right, I don't. He doesn't know what that person did to me. No, I don't. But the one who brings peace does. And God, I would pray that that prince, that leader, that chief, that ruler would show up and inspire the trust that people need today. I have a sense that someone has an issue with a family member. You are not looking forward to this season because of, I think it's a parent. You are not looking forward to this because there is outright hostility here. And Jesus is saying, do you trust me? He's inviting you to trust him. In a sense that there's somebody who's dealing with, I think it's a work issue, and it's got to be done by the end of the year, and it's probably going to disrupt your holidays. And there's a kind of a sense of resentment that you have over it. I don't know what that is. I don't know what the nature of the work is, but you're pretty frustrated with it. And Jesus is inviting you to trust him with that too. God, for all the chaos that's in our lives and in this room, would you bring the peace that we so desperately desire? And for those individuals who are wrestling right now with whatever it is, help them to see the bigger picture of what's on the other side should they choose to trust you. To believe in your name, Prince of Peace. To believe in your name, Mighty God, the one who fights, the everlasting Father who exists outside of time and space and our understanding of it, and the one who, because of that, can work wonders. And I pray, Lord, that as they walk with you, they would see those issues and those challenges kneel at your feet. Kneel at the throne. Because you are King. Holy Spirit invites you to speak, to do the work that only you can do. As we honor you with our praise, our music, our singing, our hearts. You are welcome here. And Lord, I pray that you would speak to every heart that needs to hear you, that no one would experience anything less than your best today. And I'm thanking you in advance for all that you're going to do. Amen.